Good morning and welcome to this episode of Step Into the Light. I am your host, Patty Sheen. Thank you for listening. On this show, we introduce listeners to people who have found their way out of the dark shadows of life and back to light, and those who, through various ministries and creative endeavors, lead others on their journey from darkness to light. Educators face many challenges today, from underfunding and overcrowded classrooms to violence in the hallways of our institutions of learning, from grade schools to college campuses. How do educators face these challenges in order to bring an optimum educational experience to the children they serve? My guest today, Janine McConaughey, PhD, retired from a career in education that spanned 40 years, from early childhood educator to college professor. Janine's retirement, however, stemmed from the shocking awareness that she was hiding a dark secret from the past, unknown even to her. During therapy, Janine wrote her way to healing and now is redeeming her story by helping others to understand and heal from childhood trauma. Along with Brave, a personal story of healing childhood trauma, Janine is working on two forthcoming sequels. She also keeps busy blogging at janine.org and guest blogging for other organizations that address childhood trauma. Today, Janine will share some of her experience as an educator, what she has learned about the devastating effects of childhood trauma, and how she overcame them. Good morning and welcome to the show, Janine.
Hello, Patty. It's good to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Well, Janine, it's a pleasure to have you here. I read your story, and I was just absolutely blown away by what you had to say. But before we get into that, I do know that you're living a really exciting life now because you are up there in Colorado Springs, right by Garden of the Gods, aren't you?
Yes, I am. We moved into, during my healing, we moved into an RV park, and my husband became manager. And so we have a view of Pikes Peak, and every day is different.
I bet. Well, Janine, like I said, your book is quite fascinating. But first, before we get into all that happened with that, tell us what kind of childhood experiences led you to the career choices that you have made. Did you come from a Christian home? Did you come from a home where education was extremely important? Tell us a little bit about what your life was like growing up.
Well, I come from a family that's full of preachers and educators. Preachers and teachers.
Okay.
Sometimes at a family gathering, it looks like a teacher convention. And so my grandmother was a teacher. My mother was a teacher. My dad was a pastor. My uncle was a pastor. So education was just part of my life growing up, as was the church. And so it kind of made sense that I would go into education. But really, my choice was more dependent on, I care more about the children than I did necessarily teaching. And that was always true.
Mm-hmm.
I was always more concerned about my students than what I taught them necessarily, even though that was my job. And so it's always been about the children.
And, you know, I think that's what makes a good teacher. Janine, I happen to be on contract right now. I'm grading college essays for a college scholarship application. And this is a private contracted deal. But I'll tell you what, the essays that really, really get to me are the ones where kids talk about how they were so alone and they were just kind of drifting and they really had no connection with anybody. And a teacher got a hold of them and made them realize their worth. And it's like, wow. And I wonder if teachers sometimes realize how much of an impact they can have on the rest of a child's life. It's quite amazing.
Yes, and I think that I was driven to teacher education, and I taught intro to education. And I always asked the students, tell me about a teacher. And there was only one time when somebody said, I just never had a teacher who really seemed to care about me, which I thought was tragic. But most of the time, there was a specific teacher in their life that had really made a difference. And I think that's important to remember, that the teachers are there to teach, but they're there to be in the lives of children too.
Exactly. Well, I can remember some of my teachers, and believe me, I'm remembering a long time back. But I can remember some that just stand out.
Me too.
that stand out in my mind that were just extraordinary people in their relationships with the kids and the way they were an inspiration. And yeah, it's wonderful when a student encounters a teacher, or hopefully even more than one, throughout their basic 12 years of education and then even on beyond that, you know. So, well, congratulations to you, Janine. I bet you were excellent.
You started with the little kids.
Yeah, you started with the little kids back in preschool, and then you moved into a teacher education position. So you kind of ran the whole gamut of what there is out there, pretty much, it sounds like.
Yeah, at one point I taught graduate courses. So I did everything from preschool through graduate school, yes. And when I started my college degree, I was in Christian education, and then they started an early childhood program at my college, and I just was, oh my goodness, look at this. There's a playground. There's little small children. I was so excited. Mm-hmm. And so, that's where I started. I started as a preschool teacher, preschool director, kindergarten teacher, and then I jumped to college.
Oh my goodness.
I laughed because I said that freshmen in college and kindergartners in some ways are very much alike, because they've left home for the first time, some of them, and they can't remember to put their names on their papers. I just laugh, because there really were similarities. It's a transition grade, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but that was a big leap to go from kindergarten to college. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, Janine, let's talk about, I mentioned it a little bit in the introduction, some of the problems that face educators today. And I know, well, there's many, but one of them is underfunding and overcrowding of classrooms. There's just not, and I'm hearing on the news that there's a lot of problems actually with enough teachers as well. What do you see as a future for that, for us as a nation?
Well, I think we're definitely heading toward a teacher shortage. And part of that is we have very specific ways that teachers are prepared. And there's actually a great body of people that are non-traditional, that we're going to have to develop more non-traditional teacher preparation programs towards certification. So that's one of the answers for the shortage. You know, funding is always a problem. You know, everything seems upside down. It seems like we should be investing the very most in our children. You know, I've fought that for 40 years, but that's usually not what happens. And the very smallest investment is with the younger years, where it makes the most impact. And then the greatest investment is the college years, where it really doesn't make that great of impact. They pretty much have their path determined by that point. And so, so the funding is an issue, but I think that one thing that's facing the teachers in the classroom is behavior. And my involvement with the Attachment and Trauma Network, and understanding trauma and understanding how behavior is really a needs-based situation. And we just have a lot of children in our nation who are not having their needs met for whatever reason. And so... I think that there's a groundswell. I don't know if you're familiar with the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, but it came out of the medical field. And what it did was it connected childhood trauma with, and they were really looking for medical problems later on. And there's so much to it, and I'm never going to give it justice right here. But what we began to understand is that a lot of physical problems, mental health problems, educational learning problems come out of those adverse childhood. And it's a scale of 1 to 10. And a child with 4 or more of these events, you can go online and take the survey. And
okay.
I don't mention it in Brave, but it's turning the tide in our schools, because we're getting, it's a paradigm shift of not what is wrong with this child, but what happened to this child.
Mm-hmm.
And the methods
mm-hmm.
that we use for behavior in the classroom will have to change if we're going to help these kids. And so that's where I'm involved, is childhood trauma isn't just a sad thing that happens, but it affects so many areas of a person's life.
Exactly.
So that's the future. That's the future, is mm-hmm. is for us to understand trauma and help these kids through the problems that they're facing. And I think that there's some societal structure that mm-hmm. does not exist. And,
yeah.
you know, and in my book, I talk about the fact that I survived, and I was a very productive adult, but I didn't have chaos in my home. I mean, I had mm-hmm. a lot of bad experiences as a result of the trauma, but my whole life wasn't chaos. And some of these children are just, they come out of complete chaos. There's no
yes.
place safe for them. There's no, and so I can't even, I don't know how they get up and function in the classroom at all. I mean, that
yeah,
to me
exactly.
is what we should just honor them for, is that they mm-hmm. even can function. And so, yeah, it's a problem.
Well, you know, domestic violence is up, alcoholism, this opioid addiction thing now. I mean, it's all just, you know, almost rampant. And chances are that probably at least 50% of the kids in the classroom have been exposed to at least one of those experiences, and they're living with it every day.
Right.
Which
right.
is exactly the point that you're
really
making.
That's really what the ACEs index tells us.
Okay.
Is that...
Yeah.
It does affect, you know, you can't just deal with trying to control their behavior. You have to get them help. And we're
mm-hmm.
we're going to have to change how we do education in order to help them. So
yeah. Well, I wonder too though how accurate you can be, because how much honesty do you get out of the people that complete those assessments?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, really,
So the assessment was, of course, it's self-reporting of their own childhood, okay, experiences
okay,
up
yeah.
to the age of 18.
And
mm-hmm. so you, there are, of course, people who didn't answer because they didn't, they didn't want that on a form somewhere, right?
Exactly,
that anonymous,
that's the thing,
you know?
Sure.
And so I think it's more, there's more happening than gets reported, but I think that we can't walk around and try to figure out what happened to the children. We can just help them to feel safe in the situation in which they're in, and that's what I tell teachers. These children need to feel safe. That's their primary need, is to feel safe. And so
exactly.
when making a classroom a trauma sensitive place and a trauma safe place, it helps all children. Every child feels better when they feel safe in the classroom. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Janine, we have referred a little bit to your book, Brave, A Personal Story of Healing Childhood Trauma. And I'm sure that listeners are curious to know, after kind of mentioning it and my introduction and you mentioning childhood trauma, tell us what was going on. What did
well,
you learn?
Well, the book, what I did, I really wrote my way to healing. It's been almost 4 years ago, I felt led to go to therapy, and I met an amazing therapist who took care of me as my whole world turned upside down. But the book was specifically really our journey. The therapist and I took a journey through my story and my diet, which we never actually did an official diagnosis, because we were more concerned about healing than we were that. And so, but there was no question in our mind what we were working with after we went along. So the writing that I did during therapy, I compiled that in the book. And I also, well, I'm an instructional designer, and so I had objectives, and I wanted it not just to be my story, which was of sexual abuse that began in the daycare at the age of 3. And then I just became a target. That's the only way I can explain it. I had attachment issues with my mother that made me vulnerable. And then the abuse, and children who are abused once, statistically, it will happen again, probably. And I just ended out in this cycle where I became a target, even though my parents tried their best to protect me. And so all of this was repressed. And as the parts of me that had split off in order to survive began to surface, then that is the story in the book. It's a story of healing. It's the story of the process. It's the story of therapy. It's really a story of therapy and what it takes to heal from childhood trauma, which almost always includes attachment issues, which is not very well understood. And so that's the book. It's my way to help the world. And it's really interesting because everyone who reads it and communicates with me, they pick a part out and say, this is part of my story, or this is what I learned.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know anyone who doesn't cry while they're reading it. I understand that. I'm not graphic. I don't give names. It's not a tell-all. I honor myself in everything that I do. But there's no way to understand what children go through who experience this unless we say it. And that's sad. So I don't know if that gives the synopsis of it, but I was really brave.
Yes.
I was very, very brave. I decided that the only way that I could help other people understand that what they were going through, they were not the only one, was to just completely tell exactly how messy healing is and that what they're going through is normal. So I was brave.
Right.
And,
yes, you were. I mean, yeah. And like
and
I said,
glad.
You know, I've read the book, but as I ask these questions, I'm going to act like I haven't because our listeners haven't. So, but you
right.
do mention,
right.
you know, that you experience, which is not uncommon in people that experience trauma, you experience the dissociative disorder. But you also mentioned that there are some misconceptions that exist about that term dissociative disorder. So could you kind of lay that out for us a little bit?
Yes. And I knew that question was coming, so I kind of worked around it in my description, but okay, I'm going for it now, just right for it. So, yes, and dissociation goes all the way from I was daydreaming in class today, or I drove home and I don't remember driving home, all the way to the other end of the spectrum, which is where you split off parts of your personality to hold the pain, and that's where it used to be called multiple personalities. It's now called dissociative identity disorder, and I think that I was just a really smart child that figured out that I got in trouble because I couldn't remember things that I was doing. I mean, in my second book that I'm writing, I talk about some of those, and that I needed to be able to remember, and so. So I figured out, so I did not have memory lapses, but it's very common in dissociative identity disorder for one part of your personality to be doing something, and when you shift to the other part, they don't know what you did over there.
Yeah.
And so the mind, but it is a coping mechanism. It's the only way I survived. And so the media and the film industry, they want it to be sensational. Right?
Yes, they do.
They want,
you're right.
You know, one of the personalities to be some crazy person out, you know, chasing people with, and that is just not the case.
Yeah,
it is really, the purpose of it is more to hide than anything. I didn't want anybody, you know, I tried to be as absolutely normal as possible and have no one ever suspect that there was anything wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, And so it's a disservice to what trauma does to a coping mechanism that everybody uses every day. I mean, you get up and when you go to with your family, you're kind of one person. When you go with to work, you're another, you have a role there.
Yes.
And so it's just that it gets, walls get put up between those parts, and the trauma gets frozen. Excuse me, the trauma gets frozen inside a child who gets frozen in time. And it, you know, it has, yes, it looks bizarre sometimes, you know, but it's actually what saved my life. So I look at it as a gift. And one of my objectives was to change what people thought about dissociative identity disorder, to become a different mm-hmm. face than what the media wants to portray. And so, it's very difficult to heal. It's very complicated. I had to devote
I can't even begin to imagine.
Full time, because you aren't just sending one person to therapy. I had at least 21 that had to go through therapy.
Yeah. But, you know, and this may not be a good analogy at all, Janine, because it's very basic and very simple. But when you talk about what you just did, it makes me think of, have you ever done, I don't know how techie you are or our listeners are, but have you ever done a scan on your computer and it'll come up and it'll say, we have found this. Do you want us to put it into quarantine? And it's like it walls off that thing from having any dealings with the rest of your computer. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's kind of like,
and really, that's kind of a neat analogy
part
for
of
it.
The machine, but it's something that will not, you know, the rest of the operation, but it could in a negative way if it leaks out.
Well, and I'll take that one step further because what happens is that there's triggers embedded. And for instance, they're shaking hands. I don't know if you got, you know,
yes.
the shaking hand.
Yes.
And so when I would shake hands in a situation where I didn't feel safe, that would trigger me back, and I would become the child who was raped, okay? And suddenly, so there was one day where I just stomped my feet and refused to shake the hand of the hapless church greeter.
Right.
and so what happens is it's quarantined, you know, it's kind of sequestered over here in this place, but it's still in pain. This child, it's a child that's still in pain. And if something happens to that makes them feel unsafe, then Dan Siegel says it's like the brain flips. And they're living out of that really, really broken place. And so, you know, that happens to kids in the classroom. You know, they'll get triggered and you're like, what on earth? Why did they just lose their mind right there? What happened? Well, they were triggered somehow. And that's what would happen. And I controlled it really well for most of my life. But during therapy, it was not controlled. And my husband, bless him, I just want to say right here that my husband was the rock star who took care of me during therapy. He was just amazing. But we would have moments where I was suddenly a child. And just, we have great stories, you know. And he learned to love them just as much as I was learning to love them.
Yeah.
And he knew who they were. Yeah. And, you know, we just carried on. And
well, to
and
clarify,
so,
though, Janine,
yeah.
Let's go back to the handshaking incident, okay?
Yeah.
Where that trigger brought you back to a rape experience. But you didn't physically at the time, I don't think, remember, on Tuesday night, March whatever of 1973 or 83 or whatever, this is what happened to me. You didn't have that memory, right?
No,
or did you?
I didn't at that time.
I didn't think
and
so.
Then I went.
Okay, you knew
I
something.
Went,
you just knew something was
I
making
knew,
you feel weird, but you didn't know what, basically.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that's the thing about trauma is it's the unknowing knowing. It's lurking back there. But you don't really remember it, but you know certain things you avoid, you know certain things cause you to be upset, you know. And so what I did was I took all that information to therapy, and I said, there's something about handshakes. And so through EMDR therapy, then we were able to get to the memory and process it. So that
right.
And it took the power out of the trigger. And so now, like, when I go to shake hands with people, I'm like, huh, oh, yeah, I'm fine.
You know? Which is the next thing I want to get into, Janine, is EMDR. But before we do that, we're about halfway through our show. So I like to do what I call a little break, a little station identification, if you will, because we do have listeners that come into the show after it has started and may not know what or who they're listening to. So listeners, you are listening to Step Into the Light. I am your host, Patty Sheen. Today, I am quite thrilled to have author and former educator, Janine McConaughey. Janine has a horrific and yet fascinating story to tell of childhood trauma. She has told this story through her book entitled Brave, A Personal Story of Healing Childhood Trauma. We've just been talking about some of the things that have led up to Janine's realization that she even needed to go to therapy and some of the things that came out in therapy. And if you missed it, you're going to have to go back and listen to it. So, but I do want to make listeners aware that you can do exactly that on my website, which is Patty Sheen, and that is spelled PattiSheene.com. You go to that website and you click on the Blog Talk Radio tab, which is at the very top of the page, and you will see a link to all of the shows that we have broadcast to date. And if you click on the more information section, you will also find links to all of the places where you can find my guests online. For example, Janine is on, she has a website, and she is also on Facebook, and she is on Twitter. So I invite guests to go check out the show if you've missed part of it, or if you'd like to listen to it again, or if you'd like to refer it to friends or relatives, we'd love to have you do that. So, with all of that said, let's get back to Janine and our interview. Janine, you have talked about you felt a need for therapy. You got into therapy. We've talked about dissociative disorder and kind of fleshed that out a little bit more. But a term that you did use in your book, which was an essential part of your therapy, is EMDR. So, give us a rundown on what that is, what it means, what it does for the client.
EMDR stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing, which is a really long title. But so I'm glad they just call it EMDR, but it's a research-based therapy treatment that's recognized worldwide. And it's used, it's one of the therapies that's approved by the military for PTSD. And it targets unprocessed memories, which are held in the very center, most primitive part of your brain, the limbic brain. And the body sensations and the meaning of the experience. And what it did was it enabled me to process the memory, to bring it up from the childhood experience, to reprocess it as an adult, and take the power out of the trauma. So I mentioned earlier that I had triggers that would make me shift from one part of my dissociative system to another, and I would and those were usually caused in an uncontrollable way by a trigger that related to the trauma. I mean, it was everything from Brussels sprouts to handshakes. You know, that something got connected with that trauma in my mind.
Yeah.
And so, but once I went through EMDR therapy, with that memory, the trigger just vanished. And once I understood that maybe an incorrect perception or an incorrect connection I had made, and once I worked through that with EMDR, then I understood it. It's as if your mind just has, I describe it like a card deck shuffling. You know, when you play the solitaire game on the computer, and the computer knows you're going to win, so it just starts moving the cards for you. Right. And that's the feeling. It just reorganizes your brain around your new understanding of what happened and takes the power out of it. I was at a conference and someone came up to me and he said, he had done EMDR with a car accident. And he said, a miracle. He said, yes. And that's really what it feels like. But it's a well-documented, well-researched therapy method that's becoming increasingly better understood, more widely used. We need more people trained, more therapists trained in it.
Yeah.
It's really an amazing thing. So,
well, I'm curious to know, Janine, when I was reading the book and reading about the EMDR, is there any kind of hypnosis involved in that?
No, you're completely aware of your surroundings. And it has to do with bilateral and the method that I described, and there's different ways, and they're actually developing more and more ways to do EMDR therapy. Sometimes it's with lights, and sometimes the method that my therapist used was the hand tapping, if I was a neuroscientist, I could probably explain to you why it works, but I'm not. And all I know is that it worked, and I feel like I owe my life to the skill of my therapist in using.
Sure.
And there's an entire protocol that they follow, and there's ways to it needs to be a skilled person. There's different levels of training, and my therapist had been trained at the highest level, and she had been using it for years, and I think, that was a lot. I know that, that her skill in helping me. I mean, you read that in the book. Her skill was obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, not only that, but obviously she had a great deal of caring and compassion, and she definitely had a Christian worldview as well.
Yes.
If I understood correctly.
Right. And I just want to say right here, I have such a strong faith in God, and I always believed, I mean, there were little parts of me that struggled sometimes with God's role in what happened. I don't believe that abuse is ever a part of God's plan. Not ever, ever, ever.
No.
I believe that God squeezes the good out of it, and that brave is an example. My book is an example of how God and I took what happened to me, and we just got everything good out of it that we possibly could to help the world. And so, but it's never a part of God's plan for a child for that to happen to them. But we felt. And I talk about that in the last chapter, that God had a curriculum for me. I mean, it was God's leading to therapy. What circumstances that I would find myself in, and it would be a trigger, and I would car accidents and all sorts of things that made the memory surface and help journey that just something that reminded me of something I can't even see. I just stumble around trying to explain it because it was so amazing to both of us how I was led and brought information. And my dad lived to 100, and he would give me, we never talked about what happened, but he would tell me childhood things that had happened to in our family. And I would be like, oh, that's it. That's it. I get it. And so God was in here and everything, but what I was going to say, let me just say, I forgot, but I never had a spiritual problem. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that I had spiritual problems. I thought that my depression was because I just, it just wasn't spiritual enough, never ever the case. And I think that's important for people to understand that it's possible to have all sorts of emotions and feelings and dark clouds and depression and anxiety and it not be a spiritual cause. I think that's so important for us to understand.
I agree with you 100%.
Because you just add shame on top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, and also, I think it's wonderful on your part that you didn't have some anger towards God over,
right.
You know, why'd you let this happen to me? But just like you said, you took that bad experience and along with God, you flipped it for good, which is an amazing thing.
Right, and that's what God does. And
yes.
And I think, you know, I won't say that there wasn't ever a point. You know, I remember in therapy one day, Susan Cleason was my, Dr. Susan Cleason was my therapist. And she said, so, Janine, what is your anchor? And I said, well, I know you want me to say God, but it's not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it wasn't that I didn't have anything to, I wrestled God to the mat in trying to understand everything, you know, and,
sure.
And God's right there with me and crying over me and helping me. And so, but I didn't anger toward God. I'm sure that there were times when I was angry. I don't know how I couldn't be, but that wasn't what held me all those years. It was that I really did believe God loved me. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. And you talk about, you know, that need to be accepted, that need to be loved in the book because of the situation with your mom. And I won't go into that a lot because we do want people to read the book. So we don't want to give too much away.
Exactly. So, there was a lot to that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. That was probably a big part of the whole story, actually.
Right.
But
it was.
Do you want to go into that or would you rather readers find out?
Dedication. Okay. So let me say that there are generational patterns. And we not only pass genetics down to our children, but we pass our pain down to our children.
Yes.
And so I eventually came to, I don't know what happened to my mother, but something happened to her that she was not the mother that she wanted to be, I don't think, and she wasn't the mother that God intended her to be
mm-hmm.
because of what happened to her. And
you
so,
will never know what that was.
I'll never know what that was. And I don't know that I have to know that, but I know
mm-hmm.
that God loved her and he never intended for our relationship to be what it was.
Right.
But I really honor her in breaking the generational pattern and taking the tenacity that she gave me and saying, we're going to tell the world our story so that other mothers can get help before they pass it on to another generation. And that's what
mm-hmm.
I believe strongly. So, so that's all I want to say about that.
Okay. That's fine. You, like I say, I read the book. The listeners haven't, so that's why I'm asking you some of these things. You talked about how you learned about anger without fear.
Yes.
What was the whole... deal with
that.
That
I thought when I saw that question on our list of questions, I thought, well, that's an interesting, right? And
that one really
everyone
just,
who reads my book.
It just hit me
yes.
in the head when I read that, Janine, and now I can't even recall what that was about. So
right.
hopefully
and
you
I,
remember.
I do. I definitely do. And I came to understand that anger by itself was a desire for justice, you know, that you could be angry about something that was inappropriate, something that shouldn't have happened, and you could desire justice and for the righting, which justice is the righting of the situation.
Yes.
But the problem is that when you experience abuse, your anger gets all wrapped up with fear. And so when I would get angry, it would just immediately escalate me into fear. And one particular time I was a faculty member and I was sitting in the dean's office and he said something that triggered me and I was angry. I had a right to be angry about what he said, but all of a sudden I was in terror and I tried to get up and leave and he didn't want me to leave. He wanted me to stay and finish the discussion, but I was a little girl and I was terrified. I was trapped in the situation. And so
yeah.
So I kind of had in therapy, I split those two apart. So I could, and the day that I did that, I went, I could be angry, and I don't feel like I'm going to die. I don't feel like I'm in danger by being angry, right? I was able to split them apart. And so I think that sometimes two emotions get hooked up together because of trauma of some kind, and we aren't able to distinguish between the two. So that's what that does that explain.
Yes,
that?
And that was coming back to me, Jeanine. Remember, I read that book in like 6 hours. You know, I read the book really fast because I loved it. But still, you know, I'd have to probably go back and read it again to really assimilate everything, because I was just trying to, you know, get the general overview. But I so enjoyed
it.
I so enjoyed it. I wouldn't have done it if I wouldn't have enjoyed it with me. Jeanine, you talk about the incredible and the sometimes unbearable pain that you experienced while you were working through your therapy. How did that manifest itself in your daily life? And you said your husband, you know, he had to have been a saint.
You know, we married each other to take care of each other. You know, we really believed that we were each someone who was going to stand by us and take care. And he proved it, absolutely proved it. And so there had been times in our lives where, you know, that's how marriage is. Sometimes one person's taking care of the other, and sometimes it goes the other way. But this was definitely his time to take care of me. Well, and before I answer that, we kind of skipped over, and I need to talk about that before I talk about the question you're asking me about the shocking thing that happened to me when I went to therapy.
I'm sorry.
And
I don't see
EMDR
how I missed
for the
that.
First
Good
time.
Grief. Yeah.
And I kind of need to explain that part. So,
yes, you tell.
The very first time we did it, my therapist and I decided we were going to do EMDR therapy. I kind of picked a childhood memory that it was something between my mother and I wanted to work through it to see if I could help resolve some of my mother issues. But it wasn't it wasn't trauma by any sense. And so part of the protocol in EMDR therapy is that you're processing as a child. And so the therapist says, my therapist said, can you return to your adult self now? Can you come back and return to your adult self? And I said, which one? And in that moment, the whole room just began to spin because it was my friend called it a perfect 3-point landing of the three adults in my life, my three adult parts of my personality, my parts.
Wow.
And I saw them immediately, and I knew, and she said, are there three?
Well, but she was kind of surprised.
I mean, I think it was probably one of those moments, you know, where you've devoted your whole life to this, and this person has just said, yes, there's three of me right in front of you. And so I describe it in the book as falling down the rabbit hole, and there's all sorts of Alice in Wonderland. There's so many parallels
to references
that are really kind of dissociative sounding.
Right.
And so I use that a lot in my book. But I mean, I literally felt myself falling down the rabbit hole. It had never entered my mind. Now, when I told people, they recognized the three of me instantly. I was three completely different people at times. And
interesting?
My daughter said, I just never knew which mom was going to show up, you know.
And
so she and I have this fabulous relationship. But we understand that she was raised by a dissociative mother, and she didn't know which mother was going to show up. So everyone understood, but in that moment, and I called my husband, I said, this was more than I expected. And he said, how come? And I said, there were three of me. And he said, well, that makes sense. And there we were.
Really?
And we were on our way.
Wow.
Yeah. So from there, you know, your next question was, about the pain and the
and I honestly
in fact last night I was searching, I'm working on another book, and I was searching on my computer for a particular document that I wrote, which there's hundreds, right? And I was searching for it, and in the process I was going through some of the things I wrote, and I just it didn't take me back to the pain, but it took me back to remembering what turmoil I was in. And the first year of therapy, I continued to work. And then I retired at the end of that year when the children started surfacing. I was retired. But it literally consumed my life. And it was so, because I never, and I think the point I want to make in that is that I never processed anything. I was 61 at this point. And I had never processed anything that had ever happened to me. And so there were layers upon layers and trauma upon trauma. And I honestly, without the therapist that I had who cared for me and my husband, and taking all pressure off myself by moving into an RV and just having no responsibilities, I really don't know how I could have survived it. I mean, there were weeks and months like I just didn't even get out of bed unless I went to therapy. And
Sue a lot, and you called her a lot, and you were in close contact with her. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And she retired at the very end of my therapy, and you know, she was at a point in her career where she could devote that kind of time to helping me, which isn't always possible. And I think I need to say, you know, that not everyone could expect a therapist to do what she did for me.
Right.
But I'm so grateful she did. But I think,
but you know, Janine,
and I don't want
to interrupt, maybe that was a God thing too. You know,
oh, absolutely.
That God brought the two of you together at that certain point in both of your lives. And look what has come of it with this book, you know?
Right. And we both believe that. And I, you know, because I was up to retirement so I could retire. And and there were so many things. And so, you know, a lot of younger women will say, well, I just don't think I can go through that process yet. And I say, oh, but if you could, if you only could, because every year that you live with that trauma inside of you, you're just adding more layers on top of layers. And then you end out in the mess. So I don't want to frighten people, because my process was really intense and really difficult. But it's partially because I waited so long to get help. And if we could help children, oh my goodness.
Yes.
If we could help children when the trauma happens and be able to help them to process it as a child, Brave would never have been written if I had gotten help as a child, which wasn't available. Nobody knew.
Yeah.
And so but we do know now. And if we could help the children, they would not reap what I reap for a lifetime. They just wouldn't. Mm-hmm. So that's my mission. Yeah. So, but let me tell you, when you realize that you're living as three people, which ended out to be 21, but 20 plus by the time I was done, you know, that your whole world turns upside down.
Oh, it's amazing.
You are headed for a journey, let me tell you.
Oh,
so.
That is some amazing story. Well,
so,
we'll see
and here's
what
the
happens.
Thing. I don't, because I'm a really happy person, and everyone who knew me for a lifetime and never suspected any of this knew me as this really happy person, but I was not happy on the inside. I had built this persona, and now when I laugh, one of my friends said, your laugh is different. You kind of laugh from inside you now. And that's the truth. I mean, what you hear now is, most that have known me, they would say, well, yeah, it's Janine, but I know the difference. I know that my healing is through and through, and that when I laugh, I'm not hiding pain like I was before with my laughter. So, But,
wow.
So I wanted to say that I don't want to frighten people. by my book, you know, by,
yeah,
it was really,
yeah,
really difficult. And it was, you know, I don't want to frighten people from getting help because not everybody has as complicated a story as I had, for one thing. Not everybody is 61 when they go to therapy for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so not everyone is, when I taught kindergarten, my first year of teaching, I had every possible behavior in the classroom. And I laughed about it because when I taught teachers, I said, I have an example for everything from my first year of teaching. I mean, everything. And
mm-hmm.
so I kind of feel like that about my life. You know, I feel like I could write about everything because I experienced so many
sure.
different things. And so now I just consider that a gift, but it was a hard-earned gift. But I don't want to frighten people because there is nothing that I would not have done to be where I am today. The difference is, I get emotional, but
mm-hmm.
it's worth it. I just want to say everything I did is worth to be where I am today. So my therapist is going to listen to this.
I hope she does, and I hope that she feels that we did justice. I hope she feels that we did justice
so
to your story, Janine. I really do. And if there's any lack of that, it's on my part, certainly not yours, you know, because you have been so open and honest with us. And I, unfortunately, we are getting near to the end of our time, and there's a couple of things, you know, I could go on talking to you for 3 hours, but I really do want to bring up something that ties in with this particular month. This is National Child Abuse Prevention Month, even though we're toward the end of April. Still, I mean, it's something that we should be aware of all the time. But what are some of the signs of child abuse and neglect that we should all be watching for? And I'm not necessarily talking here about, you know, just the teacher. But what about, you know, in your kids, in your neighbor's kids, in your grandkids, your nieces, your nephews, you know, these kind of – what are some overall signs that we should all be very vigilant about?
I think that sometimes neighbors know that there's something going on in a house and it's not good, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and everyone's very, very hesitant because a false accusation is a serious thing. And,
yes.
you know, it disrupts
yes.
families and it. And so, but, you know, I just think if you suspect something, first of all, it's a behavior change. I think a parent, I mean, my abuse occurred and my parents didn't know. And if your child just abruptly changes their behavior in one direction or another to being really
mm-hmm.
silent and withdrawing or to be outbursts and, you know, it depends on the child, then,
right.
then something's happened. They didn't just do that overnight for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true in the classroom. But I think trust issues. Okay, I need to say this here because it's important. If you think that a child is that you get authorities involved in it, because if you just talk to the child, it may be more frightening to them because they are keeping a secret. They
mm-hmm.
think that they did something wrong, and they won't tell you the truth necessarily until they feel
right.
very, very safe. And so watch for behaviors and get help. Bring in the authorities, you know, mandated reporters. They always are conflicted about telling and reporting. It's never an easy thing to do, but I think that, you know, our gut level, we know there's something wrong. This child is having difficulty, and there's something happening. And
mm-hmm.
I think we just need to be involved and be willing to do that. I don't know
yeah.
if that answers it. I mean, there's hotlines, there's authorities, there's all sorts of, you know, ways to report. But
right.
I think most of all, it requires us not to just separate ourselves from what we see and right in front of us. Because I think God needs us. God needs us to protect children. God cannot step down and protect a child. He needs an adult to care about that child.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
And
I did want to say that they are, children don't trust. And one of the things that we didn't mention was that I had the hardest time trusting Dr. Sue. Okay. Just, I had 21 parts of me that didn't trust her and had to learn to trust her. And,
mm-hmm.
And when a child is betrayed, it embeds distrust so deeply in their soul that, and their body. And because the man who abused me played blocks with me in the daycare. And,
yeah.
And I thought he was my friend, and I was 3 years old. And you can't even imagine how deeply that embeds mistrust. So these kids are scared. They're scared. You can see it in their eyes.
Sure.
You can recognize it. So.
And didn't you also say, Janine, and correct me if I'm wrong, was this man not also a member of your church where your dad preached?
He was, yes, he was.
Or, you know, at least a member of the congregation yeah.
Right. He attended the church. Yes. In mm-hmm. fact, most of my abuse was from men who were connected in one way or another to the church. And
yeah,
so,
and that's got to make it really tough.
That makes it very, very, very difficult. And I talk about that more in the book I'm working on now, because there's levels of, you know, but the people who were in my life that should have protected me were oftentimes ones who abused me. And
yeah.
that is so hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, unless people heal, we just pass this on generation to generation. And
yeah, we do.
I made good choices in my life. Even with all the abuse I had, I made good choices. You know, I got into some situations, but it wasn't my fault. It was the abusers. And
sure.
So, you know, you can. I had a really strong 5-year-old core that I talk about in the next book who just knew right from wrong and was not going to cross that line. And that's how I lived my life. And, but I had a dad who loved me and a brother who loved me. And I think it makes, that's what they say about resiliency. It takes one person to
exactly.
be there for a child. And that's what we have to be. It's that one person.
Mm-hmm. Let me clarify, Janine, if I understood from the book, your parents did know that this occurred, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because I thought earlier in the broadcast you had said they didn't know. But I thought, no, that's not right. I need to clarify that with her.
They didn't. Oh, so they didn't know the first time it happened.
Okay.
And then it happened again. And then they did know. But for the other episodes of abuse that happened across my lifespan, they never knew about any of those.
They never knew about them. Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
Right.
Because I remember
you. Thank
a scene
you
in the book that I don't want to repeat here because I want listeners to read it. But, you know, and I thought, well, I'm pretty sure that you know, your parents eventually found out about what was going on when you were so young.
Right. And I want to say in their defense, this was in the 1950s, and
mm-hmm.
things like that just didn't happen. They weren't talked about. If they had not made the choice not to – if they had not protected me, I would have been labeled for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I don't know that they made the wrong choice. You know, that was a part I had to come to the realization that they did the best they
mm-hmm.
could, made the
yeah.
decisions. My dad made the decisions that he felt were the best. And so, and he and I just lived out our lives together, working through it.
Yeah.
So
there was never any point
yeah.
of prosecution of the perpetrator or anything like that.
Never.
Okay.
Not for any of
okay.
them.
Okay. I
never.
Didn't think so, but I, you know, once again, I wanted to clarify for listeners.
Right. And Okay. And it's so hard because you have a child's word against an adult's and the adult's
And especially
lies.
An adult that and goes so, to church and is probably respected in the community and all that, you know? Well, I want to say again, Janine, just, yeah. you know, in my own personal, I'm just so sorry that you had to have this experience. But like you say, you're a very brave little girl and a very brave young lady and a very brave older person to have been able to process through this and stick with it and then be able to tell your story to other people so that I'm sure you are going to help others out there that you will never even know. And that's the amazing part of where God comes in, I think, when he uses us in that manner.
And I think I do, at my website, there's an email address at my website and a contact form. And I do have people who read the book and they contact me and they, and that to me, I said, and maybe this is a great place for me to kind of wrap this up as I, one day I sat with a pile of Kleenex almost as tall as my shoulder, I think, mm-hmm. in therapy. And I said, if I can ever even help one person not to have to go
right.
through what I've gone through here in this office, then
yeah.
this will be worth it. All of my pain
mm-hmm.
will be worth it if I can. I know I'm helping way more than that, that my expectation was way too low and God's was much bigger. But it's worth it to me to have had this experience. I could have done without ever having any of this happen to me. But to go through the experience and the pain of healing is definitely worth it. To help other people.
Absolutely. Okay, Janine, well, we have a few minutes left. Is there anything else you would like to bring up before we close out the show?
I buy my book.
Oh, absolutely.
I think what I want to say, and that it's connected to that, is that whenever, and this is, you know, I've done a couple interviews now, and I always get off the phone and I'm like, oh, why didn't I say this? And why didn't I say that way? Or maybe I didn't say that quite right. I hope they don't misunderstand. I don't beat myself up anymore like I used to. I used to just like tear myself up with shame for days and days. And now I just go, oh, well, this is what it was. And so so I'm fine with that. But at the same time, I wrote the book because I wanted to say it like I wanted to say it, and I wanted to go over it. And my therapist and I went over every line in the book together, and we talked through it. And so the book, it is so much better than what I've said here. And so
if
anyone has gotten anything out of this interview, I would say, please, please, please read the book, because
yes.
really what I want to say is in the book. And I know I said it right there. I can't always guarantee that I'm going to say it right in an interview, but I know I said it right in the book.
In the book.
So,
yeah.
Yes.
I would be in agreement with that as a reader.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you.
Go ahead.
I want to thank you so much for coming to the show, Janine. You really shared your very heart and soul with us, and that takes a lot of courage, and I want to thank you so much.
I think that it speaks to, I hid for 61 years and now I'm doing this. What? So
exactly.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity, because it just reminds me of how far I've come. Yes.
Well, Janine,
so
this has
really
been
much.
Wonderful. I'm so glad that we connected with each other and that you were able to come on the show. And once again, I feel like that's a God thing. Some of the ways that I get connected with my guests is like, wow.
Right.
So it certainly has been a blessing to have you with us today. And I want to thank you ever so much. And may God continue to bless you on your journey of healing and with your wonderful life up there living in an RV in Colorado Springs. I can't think of anything better. I think that would be just super awesome. And thanks again.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
I'm so glad. Okay. Bye now. Listeners, in closing, when you look back on the dark period in your life, you may find they were not quite as dark as they seemed at the time. And when the light does shine again, it is so much brighter than you remembered. I would like to urge listeners to go to the website, like I mentioned. It's Patty Sheen, PattiSheene.com. There you will find Janine's show, and you will find under the More Information tab the places where you can connect with her website and her Facebook page and her Twitter. And we recommend that please come back next week and also check out some of the other shows that we also have on the website. So may God bless you all. Until next week.
There is a candle in every soul, some brightly burning, some dark and cold. There is a spirit who brings a fire, ignites the glare.